This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This afternoon, I'm going to feature two books of poetry translations published last year by the University of California Press. And at the end, a little dollop that I think fits in well with them. These are two poets who I was somewhat familiar with, but not nearly as much as I am now. I was very interested when UC Press published them both last year at how many similarities they had in their way, although they are from over 1,900 years apart. The first is Gaius Valerius Catullus, usually just known by his last of his three names, Catullus, the late Republican Roman poet who died probably in 54 BC and who was the first to really introduce colloquial language into Latin poetry, the one who got things going after a lot of as far as we know, rather boring times before that, and led right into the golden age of Latin poetry in the next several decades. He's also known for the erotic nature of his poetry. It's very explicit at times, very scurrilous, sometimes quite obscene, sometimes very sarcastic, sometimes quite lovely, though, in a lyrical way, and sometimes lofty and grand. And in the 20th century, Miyazawa Kenji was a poet who also died quite young, at the age of 37 in 1933, and he also introduced colloquialisms into modern Japanese poetry, and a very interesting combination of devout Buddhism and a very strong belief in modern science. And finally, since both of these people reminded me of the 20th century American poet Frank O'Hara, who died about a little over 40 years ago, if there's time, I'm going to play a couple of his poems as well. But to start out with Peter Green, who's just translated the poems of Catullus. He's the Daughtry Centennial Professor Emeritus of Classics at the University of Texas at Austin, and also the Adjunct Professor of Classics at the University of Iowa. And he's written and translated many books, especially on Greek history and on Latin poetry over the last many decades. Welcome to Booktown, Professor Green.
Hello?
Hello. Oh, you are there. Good. I was afraid I had lost you.
You had for a minute.
Oh, great. I was going to recall you, and now I don't have to. Well, welcome to Booktown, and I'm very fascinated by your new translation of Catullus. I think we have to start out because not very many modern Americans know much about Latin poetry. Can you place him a bit in his time and tell us more about who he was?
Well, he was, in fact, earlier than most people think. He was not a contemporary of the Augustans. He was before them. He was in the late Republic. He was a contemporary of Cicero, of Caesar, of all these early Pompey, all these early people. He knew them all. He satirized them. They were friends of his. Caesar, actually, was a friend of his father's and used to stay in his father's estate up at Verona when he was coming down from Gaul. So he was very much in with the top people.
And he liked to make fun of them, and he liked to make fun of almost all of his friends.
Absolutely he did. Quite appallingly openly, too. He really put the boot into Caesar, and there was a great quarrel, and but they made up. And he was not, you might say, a friendly person. Now, there's one thing that I absolutely love. Harold Nicholson read about him wrote about him in his diaries, and said, "In bed I read Catullus. It passes my comprehension why Tennyson could ever have called him tender. He is vindictive, venomous, and full of obscene malice. He's only tender about his brother and Lesbia, and in the end she gets it hot as well."
That's actually fairly accurate, but there is enough tenderness in there to make up for the rest.
Absolutely, yes. It's agonized tenderness, though. It was not a happy relationship. She was older than him. She played with him. She was a salon hostess. And he was very much in love, very clearly, and had an agonized time of it. Odi et Amo, you know, the famous one. I hate and love, I don't know why, but I do it, I feel it both at once, and et crucior, and I'm on the cross, I'm crucified.
And this was, how exactly did these poems that are so personal and so emotional, how did they circulate? He never published any of them in our conventional understanding.
No, he didn't. And they don't seem to have been put together until after his death. And, of course, this has started a great argument among scholars as to whether they are in the order that he chose or that somebody chose for him. You know, was he doing the numbers? There's been a lot of that. But I think most people have now agreed that the early poems, you know, the ones that are called the polymetrics in various meters, that are the things most people know, the short, fun ones, these he probably arranged before he died, but the longer ones and the elegies, nobody knows. And it's very unlikely that they were arranged like that.
And it's complicated even more by the fact that although he had a strong influence on later Latin poets, Horace perhaps more than Virgil, and some of the satirists more even than Horace, but his manuscripts disappeared for more than a millennium.
Well, yes, indeed. The interesting thing is that he was not a household name, even in his own time. There's a very good piece of evidence for this. We have endless graffiti from Pompeii, and endless ones of Virgil and Horace. There is not a single graffito of Catullus. And he was an intellectual's poet right from the beginning. But yes, you're absolutely right. The manuscript tradition was very, very dicey, and it seems to have only lasted by the skin of its teeth. I mean, there is that wonderful description that I quote from Tom Stoppard's play, The Invention of Love, about how the tradition was so risky. As he says, anyone with a secretary knows that what Catullus really wrote was already corrupt by the time it was copied twice. And that was about the time of the first Roman invasion of Britain. And then he sort of goes on, you know, seeing the risk of the whole thing being totally lost, you know, with drunk scribes and rats and mildew and fire and flood. And then he says, until finally, and at long last, mangled and tattered like a dog that's fought its way home, there falls across the threshold of the Italian Renaissance, the sole surviving witness to 30 generations of carelessness and stupidity, the Verona Codex of Catullus, which was almost immediately lost again, but not before being copied with one last opportunity for error. Isn't it terrifying?
It's very terrifying, especially since this is the sort of stuff that you think many Renaissance scholars would have been appalled by.
Absolutely. I mean, in fact, of course, the Renaissance did very well by him, especially the Italian Renaissance scholars. The Verona Codex, it's been calculated, arrived with over 1,000 misprints, misquotations, and sheer falsifications. And over 700 of them were picked up by the Renaissance Italian scholars. It's only the last 300 or so that have been sorted out in the centuries since.
How do you go about finding an error in a 1,500-year-old manuscript that you only have one copy of?
Well, what is reasonable Latin? What makes sense in context? A lot of things will have been missed, you're right. And I suspect some are still missed that we can never know the truth of. But if you get something that makes neither syntactical, nor grammatical, nor historical, nor contextual sense, it's a fair assumption that something's a little wrong somewhere.
And then you have to figure out what it is.
Yeah, then you have to see, you have to try and work backwards and see what is proper, what would fit, and what would make sense. This, of course, is the kind of scholarship that A. E. Housman devoted his entire life to.
On a much lesser poet.
I'm sorry?
For a much lesser poet.
Yes.
The advantage, I guess, that they would have with Catullus is that although his writing is so direct, so frank, so colloquial, he still had a fascination with traditional verse forms, and
absolutely,
and he was very learned in the way he wrote and in sticking to the verse forms. But these verse forms are totally different from what we understand from or have in modern English and American poetry.
Well, of course, also, another thing about Catullus is that he survived, as you might say, through the back door. This is true of quite a few ancient authors. There are people like not only Catullus, but also the Satyricon of.
Hello.
I was cut off. Sorry.
Yeah, you were talking about the Satyricon.
Yeah,
of Petronius.
The Satyricon of Petronius. Unlike stuff like Cicero or Virgil, which was approved for use in schools and was furthered on and was sure of a good tradition, lots of manuscripts. People like Catullus got in by accident. I mean, the one manuscript was reputedly found under a wine barrel. So what we're getting through with him and some of the plays of Euripides, too, and as I say, something like Petronius, we are getting stuff that did not come through the official channels. And what I suspect is that if we knew all that was written, we would have a very different view of what the ancient world was like, because I think there's far more of these manuscripts, which are so different, as you say, than the traditional ones. And I think this would have made a great difference.
There have been many, many translations of Catullus. It's always been difficult because his language is so frank, and many people have either used euphemisms, circumlocutions, or in modern times they are more direct, but still it's been hard to figure out exactly how to do it. One translation that I know has been very successful over the last 40 or so years was the one by Peter Wiggum, which is dedicated to William Carlos Williams and tries to present Catullus as if he were a modern free verse poet. You've gone in exactly the opposite direction.
Well, actually, the Wiggum translation is a sort of bad imitation of Ezra Pound. The way it's set up is exactly like the Pound cantos.
Mm-hmm.
And, it reads like Pound's homage to Sextus Propertius. This is the kind of thing that really drives me mad, because any poem, let's face it, in whatever language it is, depends very much on its rhythm, its shape, its style. And this has been very largely ignored in studies of Catullus. And he writes in very interesting, very rhythmic metric patterns, which people largely ignore. And this is one thing I tried to do, was to copy them insofar as you can copy them in English, because English is an uninflected language with no firm vowel quantities. You have to do it all by stress.
And the stress is, if you do something like the 11-syllable endosyllabic meter that Catullus was particularly fond of, it can sound a little on the funny side. You quote from Tennyson actually making fun of it while trying to duplicate it.
Oh, yes. Well, this is one of my absolute favorite meters in all of Catullus, the hendecasyllables, which are light, witty, buoyant. And Tennyson, who is a wonderful metrist, parodied them like this. O you chorus of indolent reviewers, irresponsible indolent reviewers, look, I come to the test, a tiny poem, all composed in a meter of Catullus, all in quantity, careful of my motion, like the skater on ice that hardly bears him, lest I fall unawares before the people, waking laughter in indolent reviewers. And so it goes on. I mean, this sort of lovely, light, dancing rhythm, which is the rhythm that, in fact, Catullus uses for some of his funniest, wittiest poems.
Could you give us a version, a reading of one of Catullus's poems and then of your translation?
Yes, indeed. That was hendecasyllables. The stanza that I really loved that he also used was the so-called sapphic that was invented by Sappho, which is three longer lines and one short one in stanzas. And Catullus 11 is a classic one. I think perhaps the best thing would be if I read it in English first to give people the idea of what it was about, and then you did the Latin.
Okay.
Furius and Aurelius, comrades of Catullus, whether he'll penetrate the distant Indies, where the shores slammed by far-resounding eastern thunderous breakers, or make for Hyrcania, or the queening Arabs, or the Saki, or the Parthians with their quivers, or that flat delta to which the seven-channeled Nile gives its color, or toil across high-towering alpine passes to visit the monuments of mighty Caesar, the Gaulish Rhine, those rude back-of-beyonders, the woe-dyed Britons, all this, or whatever the high gods in heaven may bring, you're both ready to face together. Just find my girl, deliver her this short and blunt little message. Long may she live and flourish with her gallants, embracing all 300 in one session, loving none truly, yet cracking each one's loins over and over. Let her no more, as once, look for my passion, which through her fault lies fallen, like some flower at the field's edge, after the passing plowshares cut a path through it. Now you get the real thing. Furiet erali, comites Catulli, sibi in extremos penetrabit indos, litus ut longe resonantioa tundit arunda, sibi in hercanos, erabas vimoles, su sagas, sagittiferos fipartos, sibi quae septem geminus calorat aquara nilus, sibi trans altas gradiator alpes, caesaris visens monumenta magni, Gallicum renum, horribiles vitrold. Omnia haec, quae conque ferret voluntas caelitum, temptaris imulparati, pauca nuntiati meae poelae non bona dicta. Cum suis vivat, valiat qui moicis, quos simul complexa tenet traecentos, nullum amans vere, sed identinem omnium ilia rompens, nec meum respectet ut anti amorem, qui ilius culpa cecidit, velut prati ultimi flos, praeteriunti post quam tactus aratros. There it is.
There it is. And it's quite exciting, at least for me, to actually get a feel for this. It's probably the first Latin poetry I've heard recited in probably 40 years. And I think I could use more of it.
Well, actually, it's, I think it reads wonderfully. All his poems read wonderfully aloud.
Okay, well, thank you so much, Professor Peter Green, for being with us. Peter Green is most recently the translator of the poems of Catullus brought out by the University of California Press. It's a bilingual edition, so you can get the Latin facing the English. Unfortunately, you do not get Professor Green's voice in the book. Have you ever thought of recording more of them?
No, actually, I don't know why I haven't, because I did a spell as an actor years ago, and I mean, I know how to read, put it that way. Yeah, I would like to.
Well, I hope you do, and if you do, I hope somehow you can let me know.
Well, I'll do that. Thank you so much.
Okay, thank you.
Bye now.
Bye. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 o'clock. This afternoon, I'm considering two sets of translations recently published by the University of California Press. We heard Professor Peter Green's Poems of Catullus just a short time ago. I'm now going to play a talk, an interview with Hiroaki Sato, the translator of Miyazawa Kenji. And now this is a little backwards. Miyazawa Kenji is the Japanese order, and the translator in Japanese would normally be Sato Hiroaki, but he's, as so many Japanese done, reversed his name for this translation. Anyway, I talked with Hiro Sato last week and recorded his comments about Miyazawa Kenji. He's not nearly as exuberant a speaker as Professor Green, but I think you'll find what he has to say quite interesting.
Miyazawa Kenji was a Japanese poet and writer of stories for children who was born in 1896 and died in 1933 at age 37. He studied at an agricultural college and became a great believer of the potentialities of science. At the same time, partly because his family was devoutly Buddhist, he became a passionate believer in religion's power of salvation. He spelled out the combination of these two things, science and religion, or rather, the conflict between the two in his writings, and that makes him stand out among modern Japanese poets. the fact that he grew up and spent most of his life in Japan's northeast, formerly very famous as a very poor region because of frequent crop failures. This combination, the environment in which he grew up and spent most of his life, makes the science versus religion a conflict very unique among Japanese poets.
Why is his poetry important?
Well, aside from the combination of science and religion I just mentioned, his poetry covers a wide range of emotions and topics, from deeply and wildly, sometimes wildly religious to playful and humorous. He spent his formative years during a period when a range of Western things, European things, were pouring into Japan, from scientific discoveries to literary ideas, such as the importance of folklore as represented by the Brothers Grimm's fairy tales. It was also a period when modernism was in ascendance, which, as you know, included the typographical play in poetry printing. So his poems, Miyazawa Kenji's poems, dazzle you not just with its topical coverage, but with a visual pleasure as well.
What was his relationship with his family, especially with his father?
Well, his father, Masajiro, was a deeply religious pawnbroker, which in itself may be a contradiction terms. His father's business certainly did not sit well with Miyazawa Kenji. Add that fact to the usual father-son conflict, a clash of two strong egos in a situation where the son is unable to get out of his father's grip, financial and otherwise.
What role does Buddhism play in his poetry and in his life?
Miyazawa Kenji's Buddhism was of a radical variety, known as the Nichiren school or Nichirenism sometimes. It essentially posited that believing in its tenets would lead to the salvation of the nation, the salvation of mankind. As a result, many of his poems are covered with workings and no workings of that belief. Some of the followers of Nichiren school of Buddhism, by the way, you might say, put Japan out of whack during the 1920s and 1930s, just as fundamentalists in this country have put America off course in the past decade. Fortunately, Miyazawa Kenji had no chance to get politically or militarily involved in any significant way, and he died just as Japan's militarism was creating serious consequences.
How does his agricultural work fit in with his poetry?
Well, Kenji describes many aspects of agriculture, rice planting and other things, the effects of foul weather, peasant's life and such, including his conflict with some of the peasant or farmers he tried to help. The one practical thing he did for the farmers was to prepare what's called a fertilizer plan, determining what amount of manure, ammonia sulfate, soybean waste, and such should be given to a particular piece of land, a cultivated land.
He lived a very austere life. He didn't use a lot of the money he could have gotten from his family. Why was he so ascetic?
As you indicated, you know, his father Masajiro was a well-to-do man. He was also a successful stock investor. The period when, from the Russo-Japanese War in 1904 to 5, and then World War I, the Great European War. During that time, the stock speculation became rampant in Japan, and Kenji's father, Masajiro, was one of those who succeeded, made a lot of money in the stock market. But Kenji lived frugally when he had a chance. He was also an ultimate believer, sort of radical believer in the Buddhist precept. This is one of the precepts. Although many Japanese priests, Buddhist priests and so on, do not follow this precept. That precept says, thou shalt not kill any sentient being, be it a fish or an eggplant. So he was even afraid of, well, felt somewhat guilty eating, let's say, rice and such things.
He wrote a great deal during his life. He was always carrying a notebook around with him, but he published very little. He only published one book. Why did he not publish more in his lifetime?
Well, actually, he continued to publish poems and stories in membership magazines and local newspapers, but he published only one book of poems and one book of children's stories, both in 1924, and both at his own expense. Part of the reason he didn't publish any more may be the fact that he lived far from Tokyo, where everything happened. Japan is not like the United States, where there are many cultural centers, not only New York, but Chicago, Seattle, and San Francisco, and so on and so forth. So living very far from Tokyo was a great disadvantage for anybody.
The one book he did publish, or the one book of poems, Spring and Asura, what does that mean? It's a title that is a little hard for Westerners to comprehend.
I explain spring, but I don't know what I guess explained. But the Asura part, this word is Sanskrit, and in Japanese it's Asura or Ashura. The Asura are supposed to be the residents, inhabitants of one of the six realms in a Buddhist conception or cosmology. The Asura come somewhere between beasts and human beings, and they are described as restless, contentious beings, always at war with other beings, including themselves. The word Asura, or these beings are also taken to the elementary forces, projections of the forces in man's mind, according to one definition. Now, Miyazawa Kenji regarded himself as an Asura. The spring part of spring and Asura may be that is that during this season, things begin to burgeon, grow and restlessly, repressively. And in the title poem, Spring and Asura, he says, at the bottom of the light in April's atmospheric strata, spitting, gnashing, pacing back and forth, I am Asura incarnate. So Spring, as it happens, he happens to describe himself, perceive himself, just walking around restlessly. Spring may come from that fact, but he used this title, Spring and Asura, not just for his first book of poems, but the second and third, which he never published.
Now, Miyazawa was always on rather difficult terms with his father, but he had a younger sister, Toshiko, whom he adored, but who died quite young. He wrote some of his loveliest poems for her and after her death. Can you tell us more about her and what their relationship was?
Yeah, well, as you said, the affection and the sorrow he expressed in the elegies, those lovely, some of the best love poems, you may call them love poems, the best or the most beautiful, at least in modern Japanese poetry. The affection you palpably feel in his poems prompted some people to speculate the relationship between the brother and sister may have been incestuous, it's hard to prove, of course, but he took care of Toshiko when she was very ill of tuberculosis, often taking care of her bodily needs. So that is the reason for this incestuous speculation. But
living as far away from Tokyo as he did, he wasn't really in touch with the poetic trends of his time. He seemed to write in a combination of traditional Bugoshi literary style and more modern free verse. How did he fit in with the other poets of his time?
Well, as you indicated, Kenji started out writing in the traditional form of tanka, but his main body of work was in free verse. The transition from set forms, or teike in Japanese, to free verse, which was a worldwide phenomenon, had occurred by the time he took up free verse. That was the end of, let's say, 1910s, just before 1920. One interesting thing about Kenji is that he spent much of his last years, when he was laid up ill, on rewriting many of his earlier poems in set forms. Now, how does he fit in? This, as I said earlier, this was a time of the popularity of modernism, in not just in poetry but in fiction, and his startling use of science and religion, a combination of the two, attracted a great deal of attention from those people who bothered to read his or found and read his book of poems, Spring and Asura. And that is a fact, but then he stopped writing. I mean to say, he stopped publishing widely. As a result, he sort of disappeared, even though there are kind of diehard admirers of his poetry.
He's so widely regarded now that his complete poems have been republished again and again and again, and each time the edition is longer and more complete.
Yes.
What's his influence been in modern Japanese poetry? And
in Japan, he, to be very honest, I have a feeling that he's more famous as a writer of a children's story, which are very, very different from run-of-the-mill kind of stories you get. So in that regard, his stories are more widely read than his poetry. But poetry, when you mention Miyazawa Kenji, the one poem comes to most Japanese people, and that is what I tentatively call November the 3rd. That poem is something that posthumously found scribbled in a notebook he used a few years before his death. It may have been a prayer rather than a poem, at least as he intended it, and it is in any case sometimes described as a homiletic piece. It is in fact the most famous among Kenji's many poems, as a matter of fact the only poem most Japanese think of when they hear the name Kenji Miyazawa, to repeat myself. After its existence came to light, was discovered, it was used for political purposes to teach children how to be very humble in difficult circumstances and not to be greedy and so on and so forth. And as a result, some people think this poem, November the 3rd, is not a good poem at all. It's too homiletic, too didactic, and all that sort of thing. But in spelling out a desire to do good for fellow humans and a resigned sense that his wish will remain a wish, a mere wish, it is, I think, a very, very good poem.
One of the first people to translate him into English was Gary Snyder in the late 1950s. Do you know if he's had an influence on Snyder's own poetry or on other Western poets?
Well, yes, as you said, he Gary Snyder translated 18 of his Kenji's poems when he UNESCO offered him some money to do a translation of modern Japanese poetry. But in his case, I cannot really determine whether he did it because he found some of his poems similar to what he had in mind when he was becoming or preparing his first book of poems called The Back Country, published, I think, in the mid-1960s. So I cannot tell whether you can say Kenji influenced Snyder or Snyder just found him very congenital, but he's so far the only, as far as I know, the only American poet to translate Miyazawa Kenji.
You have actually published three different, not different, completely different, but three new sets of translations of his work.
The first time was back in 1973 because a new publisher established by two students who was the editor of the Chicago Review. So they named their own publisher, Chicago Review Press. They chose Miyazawa Kenji at the outset of a series of modern Japanese poets they planned for me. The second time was 1989. Jack Shoemaker, then the publisher of North Point Press, agreed to do an expanded edition of Spring Asura. And at that time, I revised or retranslated many of the things I did. I worked out with Michael Bryan. And then included a great deal more, plus three short stories, children's stories. By then, of course, the first publisher, Chicago Review Press, had all given up on poetry because the poetry doesn't sell. So, you know, when they planned the series for me, they were terribly optimistic. And also the first Spring in Asura was completely out of print. And as you may know, North Point Press, it still exists now, but as envisioned by Jack Shoemaker, soon went under, soon after they published my second Miyazawa book, which was called Future of Ice. Then several years ago, Jerome Rosenberg offered to include Miyazawa in the Poets for the Millennium series from the University of California Press. I naturally jumped to the opportunity. This university press is unlikely to go bankrupt, so I expect the book to remain in stock for some time to come.
Would you be willing to read one of his poems in Japanese and then your translation?
Oh, Japanese? I didn't prepare.
No.
I read a short four-line poem. It's not exactly a quatrain, but it's a kind of his interest in fairy tales and fancifulness and all that sort of thing. So it's called Traveler. You who go through rice paddies in the rain, you who hurry toward Leviathan woods, you who walk into the gloom of clouds and mountains, fasten up your raincoat, damn it. This is he wrote in September 1922.
And that gives a very good feeling of his general style, that he's the strong religious impulses and then his colloquial humorous side as well.
Yes. Some of his exaltation of nature, exaltation of this and that, very serious, but also has a tinge of playfulness. His elegies are very sad, of course, and his description of peasant life can be very sad too, of course. But this is one of the short poems where that show his playfulness at the same time, sort of a small person hurrying in a big landscape in the midst of clouds and rain and everything, in a humorous sort of way.
After we had finished talking, Hiro Sato asked if he could read one more of his translations from Miyazawa Kenji.
It's called a horse. It's about, again, describing a peasant life in Iwate, where he grew up and spent most of his life. It's called a horse. After working one whole day among mugwort, the horse rotting like a potato, feeling the juice of the bright sun pouring on his rumpled head, crusted with edible salt, crunched, crunched, crunched on bare bamboo at the edge of the field. When the blue night came at last, he returned to his stable, where, as if a high voltage wire caught him, suddenly he went wild. A mute struggle. Next day he was cold. They made an enormous hole at the back of the pine woods, bent his four legs, and slowly put him down into it. They sprung the clods of earth over his bent head. They shed clods of tears.
That was Hiro Sato reading one of Miyazawa Kenji's poems. His book of translations of Miyazawa Kenji has recently been published by the University of California Press. Earlier, we also heard Professor Peter Green discussing his translations of Catullus, also published by the University of California Press. I thought that these two poets had a great deal in common, and the modern poet who I think may be the most like them in his erudition and folkiness, I guess you should say, colloquial, general zaniness, is Frank O'Hara, who died in 1966. Here are two short poems read by Frank O'Hara in 1964. This has been Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned for John Rumsey's Rock and Roll Party.
The next poem is called Poem 2. Lana Turner has collapsed. I was trotting along and suddenly it started raining and snowing, and you said it was hailing, but hailing hits you on the head hard, so it was really snowing and raining. And I was in such a hurry to meet you, but the traffic was acting exactly like the sky, and suddenly I see a headline, Lana Turner has collapsed. There is no snow in Hollywood. There is no rain in California. I have been to lots of parties and acted perfectly disgraceful, but I never actually collapsed. Oh, Lana Turner, we love you. Get up. The Trout Quintet. Okay, let's go swimming. I don't want to. Well, then don't. I want some peanut butter. I want some cream soda. Last night the moon seemed to say something. It said eat. I said there's nothing. It mentioned plankton. But it had all drifted away. Do you think the sand kills stones? Keep rippling. No, I don't think that. I'm still rippling. Well, whoever said anything's done at Radio City Music Hall except the bolero? But who's ever seen it? Who asked? You will think the light comes from somewhere else, but it comes from the floor. Otherwise, you wouldn't see it. You're always looking down. After the swim, I sat and rubbed the sand into my crotch. I want to go to Spain where the olive trees.